Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 138, featuring a very good friend of mine, Darren Handler from Digital Domain. Darren and I have known each other for quite a while, and in fact, the last movie I worked on at Digital Domain was Maleficent, which he was the DFX supervisor on. And I love Darren greatly. He's really knowledgeable about digital humans. In fact, he is now sort of heading up this thing at DD called the Digital Human Group, which sounds very similar to the Digital Human League, which is something that I started up a few years ago as part of the WikiHuman project. Darren and I have been talking a lot about the similarities and differences between what we're doing, but we really think that, you know, just even starting with this podcast, that we'll probably try to figure out a way that we can work together. And speaking of the WikiHuman project, I will be going to THU, which is Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn, which, if you guys have followed the podcast for a long time, podcast listeners, you know that this is my annual pilgrimage over there. It's an amazing, amazing place. Very excited to go. And I will be a speaker this time, and I will be talking about the WikiHuman project and the big updates that we've done over the last few years, and revealing some of that stuff and contributing back some of that amazing work that we've done back to the community. So I am very excited about that. It's been a big goal of mine. This is something that Andre thought would be a good subject for me to cover because it does serve the community so well, and THU is all about serving the community, so very excited about that. On top of that talk, I'll actually be doing a bunch of interviews and stuff over there, not just as part of CG Garage, but actually part of THU itself. Andre is setting this up, and it's going to be amazing, which I'm very excited about, but I'm also very tired just because he has all very ambitious plans about all the amounts of people and that I'm going to talk to. The cool thing is that I think there's a good chance it will be broadcast live. And so I will let you guys know when that happens and where to tune in. So make sure and follow us on Facebook, etc. I know you guys already know this, but just in case, Facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast, all one word. That's where you follow all the news on a podcast. You can also follow just the normal Chaos Group site on Facebook. For Twitter, you can go to CG_labs. And of course, you can just go to our website and comment there if you want to do anything. But just follow those our social media cues, and I'll make sure and let you guys know what's going on at THU and what I'm going to be talking about there, who I'm going to be talking to. Very, very exciting. It's not just going to be about digital humans. There's going to be an enormous amount that's going to be happening in the field of architecture. So make sure and follow that, because I'm very excited about this. This is something that Jeff Muddle and I have been talking for a long time, is trying to bring more of the architecture sensibility to some place like THU. Anyway, that's all I got for now. Hopefully you will enjoy this great podcast with Darren Handler. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Hearing myself,
why do you hate hearing yourself?
Doesn't everybody?
Oh, you've got such a great voice, though. You do.
I bet you tell all the podcast interviewers that.
No, I tell all the South Africans, and that is you and David Prescott. You know David, of course.
I do, yeah. You should get some more South Africans on this podcast.
There, who else? Oh, Jason Iverson. There you go.
Mark Horsfield.
Mike Horsfield. Yes. Elon Musk.
That would be a good one.
Yeah, if I had Elon on, it'd be great. But yeah, I've always been curious and about the South African phenomenon. Tell me about it. Yeah, like South Africans in visual effects, not necessarily something that happens that much.
Well, I think it was just, you know, visual effects wasn't, especially by the time a lot of us started in the industry, there wasn't a lot of visual effects going on in South Africa. So, you really had to seek it out. You really had to find it. You really had to sort of push hard to get involved in the industry. And once you did, you know, those people were so motivated that a lot of them kind of left and went to the States and went to England and went all over to kind of pursue it elsewhere.
But there was some motivation catalyst that happened, because most of the guys who I know who are South African visual effects artists are like really high caliber, like Houdini artists at the time, which were, you know, much more high caliber people.
I think it's just really you sort it out. Like, it wasn't something you just found your way in. It was something that you, from the beginning, you realized this is what you really wanted to do, and you didn't stop at anything. Nothing stopped you to get involved in it and push forward. And then, you know, once you're in South Africa, but South Africa was kind of limited. Like, you, this at the time, and things have changed now, but you could only really do commercial work. There wasn't really that same amount of feature work going on, right? So if you wanted to do that highest end work, that meant you had to go somewhere else to do it.
Yeah, but I agree. But I'm just sort of curious about, like, the people that I know that are South African, right? Obviously, they had to go outside of South Africa to do it because, you know, you're not making the big, you know, huge budget movies in South Africa. But something motivated that technology that happened. I'm looking at people like Neil Blomkamp and you know, what you're doing, and David Prescott and Jason Iverson. These are guys who were doing stuff that were really high caliber, really well done. And I think that's it's kind of interesting. Interestingly, I was actually on a South African podcast. Did you know that?
No.
I forgot it. The guy's name is Gray. He's a super nice guy. And he contacted me, and he's doing some podcasts there. And he wanted to talk about some of the work that we're doing at Labs. And turns out that he also does CG work over in South Africa. He's still there and does amazing work. So I don't know. There's something fascinating. I guess I probably should go to South Africa and understand it.
Passion then for it. But I will say, like, I think it was also such an amazingly good training ground. Like, I remember my first job in South Africa.
Let's go back. So what got you into CG before you got your first job?
I was studying engineering. I was an electrical engineer. And mm-hmm. I think it was my second year of engineering. I saw presentations. Group came in and did a presentation on morphing, 2D morphing, and mm-hmm. fractals, and it blew my mind. It was like the most amazing thing I'd ever seen, and it just inspired me to basically cut all my classes from then on out and mm-hmm. really spend all my time at home with my computer playing around with fractals, playing around with morphing, playing around with, you know, 3D Studio Animator and 3D Studio Release 1 and,
right.
you know, that first gray shaded lit torus was one of the most amazing things I'd ever seen. And just from then on, I knew this is what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And I finished my degree, but I still focused everything I was doing towards computer graphics. My final thesis was in building a compositing package to, you know, do hole filling and, you know, paint outs and compositing operations and all sorts of things. And from there, like, I had a portfolio of work I'd done at home on my personal computer, and I went around from place to place dragging my computer, showing people what I had done until somebody...
Because you had to literally drag your computer around.
I literally dragged my computer around from place to place, set it up in people's offices and showed them the things that I had made until somebody gave me a job. And, you know, I was surprised. They gave me a job, and not only did they give me a job, but they were going to pay me. I would have done this for free. This was the most amazing thing I could imagine doing. And especially at the time, you know, this was working on, you know, Silicon Graphics machines with Softimage and Alias, and especially in South Africa, these were things that were so far out of your price range that you could never hope or dream to ever afford. In fact, my starting salary when I first started working, it would take me the rest of my life to just afford to buy a machine, right? The machines that I was working on every day. And when I started, and this was myself and a lot of the others involved in the industry, especially at that time, you know, I arrived on day one and didn't really know that much, and I was given a commercial. This is your commercial. You're doing the client reviews. You're handling the agency. You're doing all of the work. You're compositing. You're rotoing. You're tracking. It's all yours, and it's all your responsibility to deliver.
Right.
And that was the most amazing training ground I could ever imagine.
Probably pretty scary.
It was totally scary. It was the scariest thing I've ever done and probably will ever do. I mean, having worked afterwards in London and the States and things, you're working with teams of people.
Right.
Very seldom is it just you, and you are solely responsible for every single thing that goes into a commercial and everything that will work or won't work.
Right.
We did have great support, and I had a great boss and mentor, a guy by the name of Hilton Travis, who's still in South Africa, who really fostered so many of us and showed us that it was possible to do this and to leave and go to the States and go elsewhere and do this kind of work.
Right. So what ended up, did you go to, you said it to London? Did you go to London first and then to the States?
I went to London first for a couple of years and worked on a lot of like game cinematics. I worked at a company called Glassworks.
Uh-huh.
Did a lot of commercial work and things there. And from there, I kind of moved to the States and started Digital Domain.
What was your first DD show?
The Grinch.
The Grinch.
The Grinch. A beautiful show.
Absolutely. You know who I'm going to be recording a podcast with tomorrow? Johnny Gibson.
Johnny Gibson is awesome, actually. And Johnny really helped me on that show.
Yeah.
I started off The Grinch was my first feature film 18 years ago at Digital Domain.
Mm-hmm.
And I started working on
Kevin Mack as well.
Kevin Mack. And Kevin Mack was a fabulous supervisor to work with. And so I started working on a lot of creature rigging, and primarily there was something I built called the Who Construction Kit, which was basically like a generator of crowds so that artists and texture artists could actually build all these hundreds and thousands of different crowd characters with textures and everything in there.
Mm-hmm.
But
so it's basically a poor man's Massive in a way?
Well, it wasn't really sort of the crowd logic so much as actually building the characters.
Oh, okay.
You had various different character types and wardrobes you could load and put on there, and it would basically take the different wardrobes, you could change the weight or you know, whether it's male, female, age, and so on, and the wardrobes.
So like a kit of parts
there.
Kind of system.
It's kind of a kit of parts that would automatically adjust the characters and would create fully rigged, pre-built, textured, shaded characters ready to go.
Wow.
In this day and age, and it would be pretty rudimentary now, but at the time...
18 years ago, that's pretty amazing. And you have to do that stuff by hand. That's the other thing that people realize. Like, people make tools for this now that it's super simple, but back then you have to make things by hand.
It was all Mel interface. It was all... I mean, I probably spent 6 months, 7 days a week, never left the office, had the best time doing it.
Yeah.
It was the most fun I could have ever imagined building it.
Yeah, I enjoy those things. My first... My first DD show was Day After Tomorrow, when I came up with I call it the Tetris building system on Day After Tomorrow, where I was building city blocks with Tetris pieces, just so that it have enough variation of everything, and it end up. It was a lot of fun just to like come up with this idea.
Well, I feel like, and this is going to sound kind of crazy saying, but I feel like so many of the things. 15, 20 years ago, you know, maybe from the people that were doing it 30 years ago weren't really figured out. You really didn't know how to do it. And you kind of started all these things, not going into this and having these really complicated, hard problems, and you didn't know how to solve. You would sit down day one and figure like, how am I going to even do this? No one's ever really done this before.
But isn't that the thing about, you know what? Okay, let's talk about this for a second, because in 15 years ago, 20 years ago, everything about visual effects, every time you started one, it was like, show me something I've never seen before, right? And so everything was always a problem that you didn't have an answer to. You basically was like, I don't know, I'll figure it out, right? Nowadays, it's less of that. Nowadays, there's a lot of problems that are figured out, and they basically just do that.
I think it feels that way, and maybe that's just talking about it from being an old-timer in the industry, having done this for such a long time, but it does feel like so many things had never been done, and so many things, you know, we were so committed at the time, and we promised everything. Yes, sure, we can do this. Yes, absolutely. And then we'd sit down like, how do we do this? No one's ever done this before. This is brand new, untouched, having to build, write our own software, write our own things to actually do this, right?
Right.
And... you know, so many people in the industry at that time, you know, had kind of found their way into the industry, and there were so many different engineers and technologists and stuff like that. And now, and some of it has changed for the better. Like it is, I guess, for lack of a better word, like democratizing. You know, it's really so much easier for anybody, somebody at home who's got the passion to do it, to get the software, to get all the tools, and to do some amazing work, even at home, with every single thing that we currently use now in the larger visual effects houses.
Yeah, I think it's nice to have that democratization, and it actually goes back to the first story you were talking about, where you had 3D Studio Max on a normal PC, but yet everyone else assumed that they needed, you know, $50,000 worth of hardware with another $150,000 worth of software to do anything close to it. But that 3DS Max, or it was actually even 3DS Max, it was 3DS Studio. 3D Studio on a PC was significantly cheaper and did democratize them. Or Lightwave. Lightwave is the other example, right?
Absolutely.
And so I think that changed everything. And here we are now where, you know, things are significantly cheaper.
And so many people can have access to it. Like most students at home have access to a lot of the same tools that we use in the largest visual effects houses.
Yeah. And a lot of them are you don't even need to pirate it anymore because they're actually giving it out for educational purposes for free.
Which is awesome.
Yeah.
I would have loved to have started in the industry now. Yeah. At least I can say that having started in the industry 20 years ago.
I don't know. I'm pretty happy with what I am. I'm never going to change that because I feel like I don't have any regrets. You know, I'm feeling like I've done that life. I've experienced that. I've seen where it's going because I think, you know, I don't know. I think millennials have a hard deal right now, you know, and I'm a lot of people want to give them, you know, want to poo-poo them. But at the same time, they're competing in a market that's tough. So, and they are talented, so it's a little bit tough. But, okay, so you were DD, and were you on Day After Tomorrow, right?
No.
You were Peter Pan.
Peter Pan, yeah.
You were on Peter Pan when I was on that, and then were you on iRobot?
Yes.
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 That's right. That's where you and I first worked together, which was a lot of fun.
iRobot is an awesome movie.
Yes. And were you on Stealth, too?
No. I can't remember what show I was on at the same time.
Okay, so you and I were on iRobot, which was a lot of fun. But the one that we really were closely on, which is really kind of much more closely going towards what you're doing now, which I want to focus most of the podcast on, was when we first started working together on Maleficent, right? And you had become very uberly concentrated on digital humans.
Totally. I mean, I've been interested in digital humans for a really long time. I think even when I was back in South Africa, we did a commercial where we had to recreate a set of eyes, mm-hmm. human eyes, doing crazy set of actions and changing the pupils to different icons and things like that. And
right.
I think that's when I first realized, like, creating a human, creating something that looks realistically like a human is kind of, I guess, in some ways, the holy grail of visual effects. It's one of the hardest problems you can really hope achieve in visual effects. Because, you know, we all...
And a lot of people would argue that they haven't gotten there yet, but you and I know that we have, they just don't realize it.
You're 100%. Like, we're slowly getting there.
Right.
Like, I think there are so many moments when there are CG actors and CG digital doubles that people don't know are CG. Mm-hmm. But I still don't think that we've really achieved the fully performing, emoting actor that's in a movie that's for a considerable amount of dialogue that you can't tell CG.
Do you really? Because I feel, and I still hold this true, that Benjamin Buttons, a lot of people did not know that he was CG.
Totally. And Benjamin Buttons is a great case, but I think Benjamin Buttons is one of the few movies that, you know, really still holds up and people can't tell. But mm-hmm. Benjamin Buttons, I mean, and don't get me wrong, I think it is some of the most amazing work done to date in digital humans.
Sure.
But Benjamin Buttons really wasn't, you know, he wasn't emoting and talking and interacting that much. You know, his amounts of dialogue, the amounts of emoting was still a little limited.
Okay.
And so I think...
That's coming up on 15 years or something like that, Benjamin Buttons or something.
It's coming up 15, and that is, to this day, some of the best work in that arena. I think you'd be hard-pressed to point to something that of a digital character that in that many scenes that people still wouldn't know is CG.
Right.
But I think to get to the whole... You know, having a digital character that's performing for a considerable amount of time, lines and lines and lines of dialogue.
Right.
Right. And especially if it's somebody that is known.
Right. Right.
And that gets even harder, right? Especially if it's somebody that's known that holds up to that same extent. And I don't think we've quite done that just yet.
Yeah. Actually, I think it was 2007 for Benjamin Button. I'm going to correct myself. So that makes it 10 years. But... this is something we've discussed before, but I want to reiterate it for those who may not have heard the previous episodes. There is something that you just brought up with someone that is known, right? And I should point out that a lot of the same team that first worked on Benjamin Buttons later worked on Clue for Tron, right? And I think Clue was actually very good in a lot of ways, but people were having a hard time with him. The reason being that we don't know what old Brad Pitt looks like, but we do know, in fact, we know more what young Jeff Bridges looks like. So familiarity has a huge part of the discussion.
Totally.
Yeah.
And also creating an older person is easier than creating a younger person.
Right.
I mean, it's just kind of the physics, and older people have so many more sort of skin blemishes, detail, richness to their face and their skin, right? That makes it in a lot of ways easier to do, right?
Right.
Whereas with younger people, it's harder to do. And the tricky part with digital humans is that each and every one of us is a face expert, right? We may
yes.
not be experts in every area and stuff like that, but as far as faces,
from birth,
we are built, we are evolved to become face experts and
right.
identify the slightest minutia of things in the face that don't look 100% real. Right, and this gets the uncanny valley. Like we are attuned to spotting danger in faces and people's faces and expressions. Right?
Right,
something doesn't look quite right. Something's not quite normal. Something gives us an eerie, unnerving feeling. Right, and that is something that we are still seeing with a lot of digital human characters at the moment. Right,
right,
where people have a reaction to it. I don't know quite what it is. It looks kind of real, but it's not quite right, and gives me a strange feeling in some way. And that is the uncanny valley, and that's a valley that an area that we still haven't left fully. We're leaving it, and you know, we're seeing examples of work that really sort of pushes through to the other side, but
right.
we're not all the way through just yet.
No, well, yes, I agree completely. There's something about the uncanny valley to me that's fascinating. I mean, I'm actually, I joke about it with Mike, where he says, like, you know, he wants to get out of the uncanny valley. I'm curious why the valley exists in the first place, right? And I think what you said is the most obvious solution. It is an evolutionary thing.
Absolutely. Like we are attuned to looking at people's faces and spotting their intentions. Is this person going to do me harm? Is this person kind? Is this person friendly or
right.
not? And that's, I think, where it comes from.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
And so we are so good. So when something doesn't look quite right, somebody's eyes are not moving in exactly correct way, they're blinking strangely, their mouth movements are twitching in a way that doesn't look quite correct to us, or it doesn't
right.
feel natural or normal, that makes us want to flee, it makes us want to run, makes us feel awkward and uncomfortable with that person's face, right?
Right.
And that is something that CG is running into. And it's amazing to see, like, the body, like, you can get away with so much on a body and wardrobe and clothing and stuff like that.
Right.
Like people just don't notice. When it comes to the face, the slightest subtlety, everybody notices and everyone picks up on it.
Right.
Because again, we're all experts, and we're all experts from birth. And so, at least to me, that makes the face one of the hardest things to achieve and accomplish in CG and make it look real, because there are thousands of things that may be going on in a face at any one time, from, you know, the skin shading, pore detail, subtle hairs, all the subtle motion, micro motions in a face
right.
that you have to get all of them right at the same time, all the time, through all of the performances to make something look believable.
Yeah. I find it fascinating, and I'm always thinking about it, and one of the fields that I've thought about, and I know it's very hard, and it's a very sensitive subject for a lot of people, but that inability to understand an emotion, because, like, let's say you couldn't see the uncanny valley, right? It means that you can't detect emotion in certain ways, or you can't read off emotions correctly. That is a trait that we see in autism, for example. So the uncanny valley and autism have a relationship, I think, in some interesting way. And I think that people who are autistic may not necessarily be able to detect the uncanny valley the way someone that is not autistic. And that's something that I've considered to look at in terms of our own research. Like, is this the uncanny valley? Like, how do you measure? Like, the uncanny valley is like, I don't know what it is, but it's freaking me out, right? Like, something's wrong about it. But the relationship between someone who can't necessarily see, which I can imagine, like, let's imagine you have a hard time detecting emotion in terms of certain things because of your autism or whatever it is. I can imagine that life would be very stressful because everything could potentially be a danger, right?
Totally.
Because there's no sense of comfort anymore. So I just think there's an interesting science.
Totally interesting.
Yeah.
Absolutely interesting. And interesting as we kind of push forward and get to the point where people can't really tell that digital characters or digital humans aren't human anymore.
Right.
Right. It's a world that many of us are striving towards, right? But it hasn't, well, it's been breached sometimes, and there's some shows with some examples of amazing work that you can't tell, but.
Well, let's not go full conspiracy theory yet, but I do want to get there because we should note to people, we had lunch and we've actually been talking about this for 2 hours before you even started recording. But I wanted to actually talk about something before we get there, about your feeling and my feeling, which is great, and which is, I think, why we get along so well, that the importance of digital human goes far beyond filmmaking that we feel that it actually benefits a much larger part of it.
Totally.
So tell me what your feelings are and so how do digital humans serve the greater good of humanity?
Wow, that's a big question. So yeah. I mean, I think digital humans, the first applications digital humans we really see are obviously in feature films, right? And because it really takes, at least at this moment, a huge amount of money, resources to create something that's believably human in CG.
Mm-hmm.
But those things are changing, right? And I think we'll find a world at some stage where digital humans are used for lots of applications, not just feature films, but let's look to like episodic TV or content, right? Where we start to see lots of content using digital humans, digital characters that are believable, creating content. Maybe there are other performers driving it. Maybe it's people at home driving it. Look forward to a world where digital humans, as far as like digital assistants or digital salespeople, or people that answer tech calls and things like that, have a face and a persona and a personality that's a digital human, right?
Right.
These things are not near right now, but will be in one day. That all that technology is so important. All that technology is coming.
Yes. Well, you should talk to Mike Seymour about this because this is his passion. I mean, his passion is specifically about relating to giving a persona or a human persona to technology in some way.
Absolutely. And this, it's all coming. I mean, I will say that this technology, even though I'm working on it, is kind of scary, and some of the applications for it, scare me, and I'm sure scare so many of the other researchers we've talked to about it. But it's an area of development that's coming that we all have to kind of learn how to live with and learn how to accept and, find how we incorporate all of this into our lives.
I think there's something that's, if technology didn't freak you out, then it's not worth pursuing in some way, I think.
I totally agree.
And there's some disruption that has to happen for it to be interesting.
Well, I think that's a good point. I think the same for everyone to realize too. Like, although we're pushing forward to create realistic humans and no one can tell aren't real humans, mm-hmm. The same technology has scared people throughout the ages. For the first time, somebody created the first Photoshopped image or modified image that somebody couldn't tell wasn't really shot on a camera. I'm right. Sure that was freaky and scary at that time.
Yeah, now almost everything is.
Now almost everything is, and we've learned to accept and live with it, right? And now right. We have to accept and learn to live
people
with it.
People were scared about Google having all your information. Now they just accept it.
Well, I'm still scared about Google having all my information, but yes.
But they give me the ads that I'm interested in, so that's all that matters.
And much, much more.
And much, much more. Yes, it's true. I mean, all right, and that okay, so, but here's another thing that I think is important, and I've sort of mentioned it before. If there's another aspect of digital humans, right? The more we understand what makes digital humans successful, and the more we can identify what makes someone feel human or alive, then the more we know about ourselves in some ways. So we've just sort of always accepted it. And that's the classic problem, right? That you and I have discussed before, where I don't know what's wrong, but I know something's wrong. And it's identifying what is wrong is actually a much harder task than identifying that something is wrong.
Totally.
And so if I can identify certain things, then I will actually be more attuned to other things, right?
Absolutely. And that's even with digital humans. One of the interesting things too is like, I think we've really gotten to a stage as far as digital humans where we can create something that is believable as a single frame.
Right.
Right. As this is a single frame of a person, an artificial person, but that looks real. But we haven't really sort of fully gotten to the point where we have emoting somebody's dialogue, speaking lines, saying things that, conveying so much emotion that is really believable. And there's a whole element to kind of believable human motion, which we haven't quite fully figured out and grasped. But together with all of that, like as we start to get to that point, there's so many other avenues of interesting research and stuff like that where this benefits as far as like medical research, understanding of human faces and human motion and digital aging and all the different ways that this can help us spotting different conditions. And
yeah. And what do you think we're going to do with all this stuff?
I think we're going to make a lot of YouTube videos that are pretty freaky and unnerving.
Yeah. So there was some interesting, and then now we can go full conspiracy theory, because there was a lot of news that happened around digital humans, and not necessarily fully CG humans, just manipulating video or changing dialogue or doing other things that have happened. And one of the papers, I'm not sure who, was it Disney? No, who did the paper with the Obama thing?
You know, I don't remember offhand. Yeah,
I'm blanking, so, and I'll put it back in the notes at the beginning. But it was Obama talking, and they basically used an audio file from a different speech that he said, and then had a different video file reenact that same speech, which is interesting as a problem, as a technical problem. But they specifically chose political figure to illustrate this. And they did the same thing. I don't know if it's the same people, because I think it was Sanford and the Max Planck Institute, or I believe that it was, they did the puppeteering of a political figure. So they had Putin and they had someone else moving their mouth and Putin
puppeteering them, yeah.
And puppeteering them. And they did it again with a political figure. So the point they're making is that you have a hard time knowing what's true up to a point.
And I think that, you know, like we've slowly stopped believing that a photograph is real, we'll
sure.
slowly stop believing that movies
or video
things that
real.
Video that we see is
so
real.
So when you call out fake news now, you may actually have a defensible thing.
Well, fake news could be an image, and sometime soon fake news could be a video. Yes, and that
could be a completely fake speech by someone that looks completely
and that
real.
Time is coming where we don't really believe in that, or you know, and I think this goes to sort of a lot of the news articles and things that you see at the moment, or images you see. If it's published by a reputable news outlet that
right.
has done some research and analysis of it,
mm-hmm.
then you believe it to be real. And the same thing will go for video too, right? Like where it comes from and who actually releases it and the analysis they've done on it. Because even once we start to get a fake video, there will be groups doing an analysis and forensics and research on it.
Well, there is. There's actually some really interesting work, which I can't necessarily talk too much about, but there's some very fascinating work being done in digital forensics that can spot those things and those differences. Eventually, those things will be, you know, harder to spot. But and my guess, if you basically said you have 1 minute to decide how are you going to – what technology will eventually beat digital forensics, I would say deep learning.
Yes. I mean, deep learning is a field that is amazingly interesting and yields amazing good results. And I think you would see like most digital human technology at the moment is based off of deep learning.
Right.
It's something we're using in digital domain a lot as we sort of look to faces, as we look to training computers as to spotting how a face moves and to recreate that and recreate that on a different character and
yep.
feature.
Yeah, we did the same thing on Mike. Mike specifically actually worked with Epic and the guys at Cubic Motion, because the thing is, he had to puppeteer his face and it had to create all the blend shapes and all the emotion at like, you know, 9 milliseconds or something like that, right? So it had to create really fast. So the only way it could make sure that the rig or whatever was working at that speed was to have enough learn data to use deep learning to make it work. And it worked really well.
No, the results looked amazing. I mean, you know, that's real-time digital humans still have a ways to go.
Yeah, but they've come a long way.
But they've come a huge way and they're going even further. And it's something that, you know, again, at Digital Domain, that's something we're actively looking at as well. It's like, you know, we can render a photoreal, realistic human being, but mm-hmm. we want to be able to do this in real time. We want to have somebody that's actually able to interact with you. And that is not going to be fully real and 100% photoreal and believable as a person right now, but next year, the year after that, maybe.
Who
right?
knows?
That technology is really,
well,
really
let's,
coming.
Well, let's actually quickly talk about what is it you're currently focused on Digital Domain? Because you talked about you're not necessarily doing the same kind of things that you did. You are pretty much 100% focused on digital humans, right?
Totally. So at the moment, I'm overseeing a group called the Digital Human Group, mm-hmm. and we are involved in looking at all technology related to digital humans.
Right.
And this technology could be for our feature film division, it could be for commercials, it could be for VR, virtual production, and looking at ways that we can actually market and leverage this in sort of other applications, just even from a webcam. How can our digital human technology, the stuff that we're building, be used by everybody at home?
Right.
And together with that, you know, we're looking at creating digital humans, but also, can I capture digital humans' face and drive a character or a creature?
Right.
How does my actors for some of the biggest blockbusters features, how do they drive a different creature or character's face in a way that looks like them, is kind of believable as them, but it's not really truly them and looks different to them, but mm-hmm. captures all of the subtlety and nuance in that performance?
Right.
And then I think it's kind of the area we're really looking at. It's like, so much about a believable performance is about subtlety and nuance. There is so much in a face
yeah.
that we really need to capture in order to make it look believable and real.
Yeah, there's the face is the thing, right? So I always, when I talk about my digital human, I always sort of think about, you're a father, and so you've been here when my daughter, my firstborn, she arrived into the world and she was freaking out because she just, you know, birth is a very traumatic experience. But the doctor put her in my arms and I was looking at her, she stopped and she stared at my face like hardcore. So the first thing that this baby did when vision meant something was to stare at a face. There was nothing, of all the things that she could look around in the world, a face was the first thing to focus on. And they're hardwired to do that. So from very second of birth, a baby looks at a face. And we know this better than anyone else. By the age of 2, you are an expert in facial expressions, right?
Totally. And that's an interesting thing. Like, the way we even represent faces in CG, at least at this moment, often don't really capture what a face is truly capable of.
The because
way
sometimes we're being too scientific about it.
Sometimes we're being so scientific about it. Like, and so, you know, there's so much subtlety and so much range in a face, right? And, you know, that's something we're really, at least our group is really focusing on. Like, how do we capture all of the ways a face can move?
Right.
All the ways the skin can move, right? How do we capture all of that and represent that?
Right.
And how do we target that to a different character? And one of the things we do, we have a process at Digital Domain called Direct Drive. And it's really, I guess it's kind of a different way of thinking about driving a face where you're not, we don't capture an actor's face and then sort of represent that as the series of facts, shapes then and sort of say, okay, he's smiling this amount and his jaw's open this amount. And
We
sort of capture the actor's face and say, these are the points that represent the actor's face. These are the 10,000, 100,000 points that represent the actor's face.
Mm-hmm.
And then we look at all of the ways the actor's skin is moving. And then we look at, say, we want to transfer that to a different actor or a different character. We look at the anatomy of the actor's face. Okay, here is the actor's face. Here is the actor's, say, bone structure of that face.
Mm-hmm.
Now we want to look at this character's face. Here is this character. Here is the character's bone structure. This is how that actor's face and the way those points are moving on their bone structure would look on a different character's face and the way they'd move on a different character's face.
Right.
And then on top of that, we throw in some other things like, oh, well, when the actor's moving his face like this, we transfer this to the character's moving like that, but really we want it to move a little bit differently. Then we throw some training and machine learning into the process.
Interesting.
Tweaking the process, but trying to really stay to the idea of, this is realistic human facial and skin motion.
Right.
And how do we represent that on a different character in the same kind of way without going through a rig or specific key muscle shapes or really just looking at realistic human skin motion and
right.
using that and transferring that. And so much of, I guess, the most realistic face motion things we're seeing is really built off these human face models, right? Mm. And I think that is where we're kind of going to, where we have computers that can represent all the ways a face can move as a full statistical face model that we can then use and leverage. And our understanding of exactly how the face moves and all these various ways faces move and how different people's faces move, we're building these very, very big models of faces that will allow us to create more and more realistic and believable faces.
So basically the more data you have, the better your animation, right?
More and more data. I think that is where this is going. It's not just scanning a few face shapes and saying, this is how this person's, this is the mouth open, this is their mouth closed. No, we want to see them open their mouth 100 times. We want to see them close their mouth. We want to see them do every single different performance in different ranges of emotion. We mm-hmm. want to build a database of how every point in their face moves when they're doing every single different expression. If we truly want to understand how a person's face moves.
Right. Yeah, I think. What do you think about the more anatomical way of doing it with like muscle systems and things like that.
I mean, I've seen some interesting stuff for muscle systems, and it is a very interesting area. Like most of our development has not been in that range. We've stuck really more to sort of capturing exactly how the face moves and then anatomically transferring that. Mm-hmm. The thing with muscle systems is that you can represent all the various different muscles, and then you have to represent all the various different fatty tissue and the various different connectivity on the face. Mm-hmm. But then what if you're getting a result on a face that's not that axis face, it's not quite what you're looking for? How do you then change that? How do you then represent that and delve down into each different layer through there? And, you know, it's, I haven't seen a lot of muscle-based facial systems that give the realism that sort of a more captured approach can give us, a more data-driven approach can give.
Right.
But that may change. We'll have to see.
So
there are a lot of muscle systems that work on the body and work really well on the body. But
sure.
On the face, there's a lot of various different muscles, connective tissue, fatty tissue. There is a huge amount of complexity to the face.
Here's the thing, right? So let's go back to we're talking about, all right, let's go back to the original thing. Is you had the fact shape system, which, or even earlier than that, you had phonemes.
Totally.
Right? And phonemes are basically like what your face, shape of your face when you're saying different letters. And that's about it. That's what it was. Back when I was doing iRobot, that we had phonemes. That was, I think, what we had, right? And then it evolved into this fact shape system, which I believe came from the 70s, from Berkeley, I think it was.
Yeah, it was the facial action coding system.
Right. And it's a different way that your face muscles could act. And that basically the derivation is that every facial expression that you have is a certain percentage of these different shapes, right?
Exactly, right. So trying to break the face down into a series of different muscle groups and the various different shapes based on those muscle groups so that they can all interact and work together.
Right. So you capture 30 different shapes or whatever the fact shapes system is, and basically say, okay, so when you say, oh, it's 30% this, 20% that, 9% this, whatever, you keep going. So that's the way that the fact shape worked. Actually, that's been what a lot of people have done. They still capture facts, right?
And that's still the way a lot of faces are done at the moment.
Right.
Capturing facts. But then what also gets very different is like as you engage the various different shapes together, right? So you can isolate each individual fact shape on its own. But then as the various different shapes are added together, the way they interact together doesn't necessarily work exactly correctly in the same way in a linear blend shape model.
Yeah, that's the problem about blend shapes is that they're linear, right? It goes from A to B and there's like – it just goes straight A to B. There's no emphasis on one side or curvature to the shape as much.
And for instance, if you're adding different shapes together, the way their shapes interact with one another is not the same as each individual shape on their own.
Right.
And so now you have to put in together combination networks. Oh, this is what happens when shape A and shape B engage.
As opposed to just A and B individually.
A and B individual. And this is what happens when shape A, B, and C engage. And this is what happens when A, B, C, D, E engage, and so on and so on. And that becomes a huge network of various different shapes. And still, even though they're the correct isolated shapes, doesn't fully represent how the face may move and all the various different variations of it.
Right.
And that also takes, and this is something we did on Maleficent, it takes a huge amount of time to build up all of that, all those various different shapes to the accuracy you need them in,
right,
to build a face rig that is now capable of talking.
Right.
Right. And so that takes a huge amount of time to build that. So why not just come up with a way to capture that up front?
Right.
Here is an actor doing a full performance. Here is exactly how their face moves. This is their face. Right. Now we can recreate, represent it. We can make their face do whatever we want to do. And we can also now transfer that face and that whole facial database of how their face moves to different characters and creatures.
Right, right, right. Well, I remember, I mean, we had, and it you know, let's you know, we can use Maleficent as an example, but, you know, the huge amount of work it took on Benjamin Button's to build that entire fact shape library of Brad Pitt was a big amount of effort. But once you'd done that, then you go to the next movie, then you already had that history, so you can transfer some of that and transfer some of that. And so it became easier as you moved along. I know you guys have moved past this.
Well, it's kind of easy, and this is what gets tricky. So you have, and we have, huge face libraries of face shapes and stuff.
Right.
And so we take a new person or a new actor or digital double, and we take their face, we're transferring their face library, and mm-hmm. we get a smile, pretty plausible smile, looks like a smile, and chin razor and nose wrinkler and brow razors and all the shapes. But it's not the same way that person would do that shape.
No.
Each one of those shapes is looks like a shape where you're raising your brows, but it doesn't look like the way that person would have raised their brows.
Right.
And that there becomes the tricky thing, right? It looks correct as somebody raising their brows, but not necessarily as that person raising their brows.
Right.
And now you have to make each individual shape correct for that person, that right. actor. And that is, at least in that old, the paradigm of blend shapes and fact shapes and combination networks, that becomes a huge amount of work, right? And so something we're doing is like, we want to be able to capture somebody, capture them with a helmet camera rig and stuff mm-hmm. like that, and a week later see their facial performance. Right. We don't right. want to go through 6 months of building each individual shape, make sure every single shape is exactly correct, and then be able to now get a performance for them.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely the way I was doing it back when I was there with you guys. But now it's different. Like you said, like you're not necessarily as interested in the fact shapes anymore. You're looking at things where you're capturing the performance for every frame, right?
Totally. I mean, we do still have rigs, and because ultimately we know that no matter what, even though we're capturing the actor's performance, we may have to modify the performance, we may have to change the performance, we may have to do all these different things. So we always do have a face shape rig mm-hmm. underneath there, but it's generally secondary. It's not the primary thing. We try and per frame capture what the actor's doing. And right. maybe that's just our approach, and maybe just somewhat my approach. It's like we are looking to the actor to deliver the performance.
Right.
We want to, the actor works with the director, we want them to create that performance. And then we want to represent that performance, whether it's on that actor's face in a different shot or a scene that they couldn't do or on digidouble.
Right.
Or whether it's on a creature that's almost their digital makeup on that person delivering their performance as a different character.
Right. Well, what do you think about the ethics of that? Like how you perform it? Obviously, like, listen, if I had to look like a rhinoceros version of myself, then that makes sense, right?
Are you asking me if I sleep well at night?
No. I mean, think about it, because there is something that used to bother me. It used to bother me when we would recreate dead actors or whatever's going on. And I could justify it sometimes, but I couldn't necessarily do it. But there is some ethics. I think when we get to the level that like you are, right, where you really know about what it takes to create digital humans, what do you think of the ethic responsibility of that power?
Well, that's a hard question.
Oh, yes. Because I've had to answer it personally as
so
well.
So I would say, as far as the ethical responsibility, and it's most of the work we've done, at least in the feature films we've been involved in, mm-hmm. a lot of our line has been on the, we are trying to recreate the actor's performance. And we work with the actor up front.
Yeah, yeah.
Knowing, telling them that, you know, what we're there to do is not to recreate or create a new performance for them, but really to take their performance and put it onto that character and have them drive the performance.
Sure.
And the way we look at it, it's almost like digital prosthetics, right? At some stage, you may have an actor wearing a full prosthetic appliance on their face to create a different character.
Sure.
Well, we are their digital prosthetic. We are going to take their performance and drive this digital character as closely as possible.
How do you think animators feel about this? Because you know the whole, I mean, does, if you really feel that way, which I think is legitimate, and I know we'll you know a little bit about the technology you guys use, you actually come very, very close to doing that specific thing, which then brings back the whole Andy Serkis thing. So let's talk about that for a second, because I think if you're really saying, I am just digital makeup, then does Andy Serkis really have to say, like, no, it was all me?
Well, a lot of that really depends on the feature in the show and the application for it and how much that really gets changed. And
right.
I think there are lots of different features that have, you know, sometimes those performances are changed drastically and sometimes they're not.
Right.
You know, a lot of the shows that we've worked on, we've modified and adjusted and stuff like that, but it hasn't really been a drastic departure from what the actor's been doing.
Right.
And our animators, and we have some of the most amazing animators in the industry, and we have so many animators that are so attuned to how to animate and create realistic facial motion.
Mm-hmm.
But those animators are still looking at that actor's face as that reference for what does that performance look like.
Right.
And so we're capturing the performance, and there's still elements, you know, and it has changed through the shows that we've done how much we have to animate on top of those performances.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we were still looking to that actor's face and what that actor was doing, assuming that the director and the actor liked the performance and that's the performance we're going for. And we've been lucky enough to be in that position where we've really been able to work with directors and actors that have gotten a performance that they like and we're recreating.
Absolutely. Okay, so I realize that some people, a lot of people who know about Digital Humans immediately know when I said the Andy Serkis thing, but some people may not. So I'm going to go ahead and explain that a little bit, if that's okay. So Andy Serkis is a very famous, is an actor who is famous for doing, playing characters that are represented in CG, right? So his most famous one that he started with was Gollum, and then he's also done all of the Apes movies and a bunch of other stuff. And so Absolutely. He's even started his own Mission Capture Studio, et cetera, et cetera. And his performances, the performances of the characters that he plays are very empowering characters. His argument is that he should be, as a motion capture character, he should be eligible for an Oscar for the performance that he gives. The argument from the CG people saying some CG people is like, not all of that performance is his. Some of it comes from the animator who enhanced or changed or altered or whatever, made that performance as good as it is. It's not directly driven from the motion capture system. So there's a bit of an argument there. And obviously the CG world and the live action world don't always get along so well in terms of recognition, in terms of who wants to be recognized for what work. But the technology you guys are doing is so good that Andy Serkis's argument is actually a very valid one.
I think it's valid. And I think, you know, you can really see both aspects to it, because I'm sure there are so many productions where somebody had done facial capture and that was modified, adjusted. It was a completely different performance by the end, right?
Right.
So, unfortunately.
So even if the capture itself was really good, it didn't necessarily work as well in the scene. So the animator has the power to change that performance to make it work better.
Under the director's guidance.
Of course, under director's guidance.
And this is it.
It's the same thing. You can use the same argument. Like an actor, an editor can make an actor look really bad with a bad edit, right? Even though the performance was identical.
And like with all things, because you have the ability to change things means things could be changed, right?
Sure.
I think there is a case to say that, you know, there are many, many actors that will be doing performance capture and facial capture that should get an Academy Award and should be nominated and should, you know, are the ones responsible for it. There are other cases where that's not the case. And it's going to be kind of hard sometimes to figure out what is exactly true and who should get that award. But, you know, how do you give 100 different people an award when those 100 different people worked on the character?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, honestly, like my concept when the Andy Serkis thing was like, well, if this gets nominated, it should be one of the first acting awards that goes to two people, would be the actor and the animation director. Would be very, very unique. But at the same time, you know, some people get credited for, like, I hate to bring it up, but the guy who, the DP for Avatar got an Oscar, and geez, two-thirds of that movie was all CG. The DP was never involved.
There are a lot of cases like that. And again, that's why I say it's not going to be cut and dried and a very easy thing to sort of solve. But I will tell you, there's going to be a lot of cases where the technology gets to the point where the actor is driving that performance and
right.
that actor who's driving that performance should get that award. And other cases where that's not the case and all of it got modified afterwards. And, you know, the Academy is going to have to do an interesting job of figuring out how do you nominate an award and who gets that award.
Yeah. And I should point out the reason it's so sensitive is that especially – I also was wondering when I went into the movie industry and I sort of, you know, started working and like Oscars were like – you could tell some people were just 100% motivated towards Oscar nominations, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, okay, it's cool to get nominated. It's nice to get an award because, you know, I've been nominated for different things here and there. And it's like, oh, wow, that's so nice. Thanks for honoring me. But the reason Oscars are so, so competitive – is that there's a lot of dollar value behind them, right? So if you're nominated for an Oscar or you win an Oscar, your value as a person goes way up and your salary goes way up. So
prestige
is dollars, right? And that's what it comes down to. It always comes down to dollars. so that's what's important about it. And I think it's an interesting thing. So, but it does, just even that concept of, I mean, there's so many things that we could touch on that are the ethics of digital humans. Like if you even talk about, you know, getting an Oscar for acting and related digital humans, it's really, really interesting. But what are some of the other things that let's say, that concern you about digital humans?
Oh, there are a great many things that concern me about digital humans. I mean, we actively work on creating technology that will create a digital human that you can't distinguish from a real person.
Right.
But at the same time, there's a lot of questions about that, like, how could that be used? How could that be used in ways that you wouldn't want that to be used? Could your likeness be used in ways that you wouldn't want your likeness to be used?
Right. What was the scenario you were talking about at lunch? You were saying, there's probably enough pictures of me on Facebook and videos of me that someone could, with deep learning, totally, in a not too distant future, could
totally commute. Facebook could look at all of the pictures and videos of Chris Nichols and build a Chris Nichols face. And then with all the videos they have of realistic facial movement, maybe not right now, but several years from now, puppeteer a Chris Nichols face to do pretty much whatever it is that they wanted to do.
Right.
And who owns that? Did you sign away your rights to your face and your likeness
when
you
signed up to Facebook? I did, when I signed a Facebook agreement,
What can they use that for? If you become famous, can they use you to sell advertised merchandise, whatever it is they want to do? Like,
well,
what is,
yes, to some extent. I mean, there is such a thing as slander, right? There's such a thing, there's different kind of, okay.
We don't even know how this is going to be used and where this is going to go yet.
Right.
This is not fought, the various different cases have not nearly even come fought its way through courts yet, right?
Right.
Everyone's just getting to grips with what this
is. We haven't even figured this out. Legally speaking itself, this is going to be like, lawyers are just not even know how to touch this.
And that is coming, right? Facebook doesn't know quite what they can do with your face just yet, and you don't know either, right? And that,
well, they're already doing it. They're just not showing it to you.
I have no doubt the developer's looking at your face right as we speak.
Hopefully not mine, but
it is true, and it is coming, and the technology is, it's not there yet. It's just in the earliest stages of research and stuff. But, you know, 5 years from now, you know, I fully believe that somebody will be able to, using recognition of a certain person, be able to gather enough imagery of that person to be able to create a digital version of that face, and then be able to puppeteer that face and have them say all sorts of different things. And, you know, who owns your face, and what can somebody else do with your face when those images are publicly available?
There was a, and I think this is actually an art project, which was fascinating. It was a guy in Russia, right? Of course, it's Russian. But what he did is he would ride on the metro in Russia, in Moscow, I think it was. And he would take pictures of people that he would just see just on their phone, whatever, just random passengers on the train. Mostly women or attractive women. And there's a reason behind this, right? He would then use his facial recognition algorithm that was available. I forgot what it is, but it's a very commonly used facial recognition algorithm to find that person on the Russian Facebook thing, right? And find a picture of that person that was, you know, usually like a selfie, like glamour shot thing, right? So like found this random person on the subway and then use my algorithm to know exactly who that person is and reveal the picture of them that they probably would have not wanted to make public, but because they put it on a public site, it's public. And the whole thing is like, it was a little bit like the research on the using Obama, right? You specifically chose Obama to prove a point about the ethics of it, and this guy did the same thing. It's like, it's basically, if you're going to sum it up, it's like, watch what you put up on Facebook, because it's so easy for me to find you.
Absolutely.
And it's a little disturbing in a way.
People aren't going to change. Everyone's going to upload their imagery, and that's not going to change. And even the concerns and things are not going to really change. And we're all going to slowly learn how to live with and what our boundaries are with this technology and what we're comfortable with. And we're going to, I think, grow to be a lot more comfortable things that right now we feel pretty unnerved by.
Right. Digital Chris. Or Digital Darren. I like Digital Darren too. It's like double D. What do you think, as people who are involved in this, who know a lot about this, what do you think our responsibilities should be or could be? Do you think that we should work now to address this as an issue and find a way to protect our I don't necessarily say protect our identity but find a way to identify the different things that are going on and do something. Do you think that we have a responsibility as experts to deal with this?
Well, I'd say the first responsibility, and this to me is the most important thing, is to make it publicly known what is happening and what's available and what people are doing.
Right.
Right. And I think that is the first key thing, right? Better than trying to change the way things are done or to change the development and things like that, because ultimately this is going to happen, and no matter where it happens, it's going to happen by somebody, and this development is happening.
Better
in many
make people
areas.
Aware that this is possible.
Everyone should be kind of aware of what are the kinds of things that are happening, what is actually being done, what is actually possible and capable at this moment, and then how to best deal with and understand that, and what does that mean for everybody, right?
Right.
I think that is the primary thing that is the most important part of all of this research and development at the moment.
Yeah, I think that there's a very big responsibility we have, and I think when we look at that research, the stuff with the puppeteering and the fact that they used Putin for that puppeteering was very specific, or the Obama saying different things. They are calling to this, saying, this is technology that we found. If we didn't find it, someone else may have, and you should be aware that
totally
this is out there. So I think that's a valid one, yeah.
I think something to be aware of too, and maybe this helps alleviate some of the fears too. I mean, this was being done 20 years ago. Maybe not in the same way,
right?
But there were movies 20 years ago, I think Forrest Gump was one of them, where they took footage, past archival footage and stuff like that, and changed and reanimated people's faces.
Right.
It was done in a more manual way. It took a lot longer to do, but it was still possible, right?
Yeah.
Frame by frame, changing, painting back, adjusting, morphing what somebody's lips were saying and stuff like that to different dialogue. It was possible. It was being done. There was an outcry, people concerned back then.
Right.
Now it is definitely easier. Maybe happening more often,
right.
But it's not so brand new and, you know, different. You know, we're all going to learn how to live with this and become used to this. But the primary thing is important for all of us is to know how what's capable and what's being done and what's out there at the moment.
Yeah, I think it's very easy to go full fear factor on
full
this.
Full paranoia.
Yeah, and that's legitimate. At the same time, I think that we have really amazing technology, and that technology can and should be – you shouldn't just like pull the plug on it just because you're paranoid. I think that there's important things that digital humans have to
do. Well, it is impossible to pull the plug on it. It's going to happen.
It's already happening.
It's happening. There's so much research going on in this area. This development is happening in many, many different places across so many different areas of technology. It's going to happen. And we'll never pull the plug on it, and there will be massive benefit from it,
right?
There will be downside. We don't know what that downside is just yet, but there will be huge benefits. More information targeted to us in a way that's more meaningful to us. You know, I have no doubt there's a lot of application in different medical industries and things which we aren't even quite aware of right now.
Right.
In speech, learning, all sorts of other areas, right, that haven't really been fully explored. So there'll be upside. There'll be downside. We don't know what those downsides or upsides are just yet, but that technology is definitely coming.
Yeah, I still think that digital humans just literally, you know, I can sit there and fiddle like with digital humans for a long time, where I'm just worried about the subsurface or figuring out the specular lobes. And to me, it's still fun to do, and it's really exciting to see like a really realistic human. Like, you get excited when he's made something look so real, especially that, like you said, it's the holy grail of CG, right? If you make a digital human look completely believable, like, it's...
I've made a person that somebody doesn't know is not real, wasn't really there at the time.
Right. And there is something amazing about that. So I get excited about it. I do get a little concerned when people talk about all the different ways it can be applied, but I think there's something really, really fascinating about it. And I think that people like us have a responsibility to make that information available to people and help general growth in this area. So I'm excited about it. Very excited. Well, I know we're kind of just around time, but is there anything you can tell us about what you're doing? I mean, obviously, you started your Digital Human Group, which is, sounds very similar to the Digital Human League. So we should probably think about like how the Digital Human Group and the Digital Human League can start working together. That would be awesome. Great. Yeah. But it would be really cool to sort of know what you guys are doing there. And, you know, maybe we can continue discussing that. But what are some of the other things that you guys are working on, or some of the accomplishments you've done that people can see some of your work you've done out there?
Well, we really haven't really, I mean, some of our work is kind of, I guess some of the work that we've done, you can see on various different feature films,
sure.
right? As, you know, Beauty and the Beast and some of the work Maleficent and mm-hmm. other films that are currently in production and stuff. Because really our group is involved in all of human technology, all the technology around capturing a human, recreating a human, digital human skin rendering, and not just for feature films, but also looking towards like creating real-time humans, being able to very quickly and easily capture people, capture actors, transfer them onto creatures, transfer them onto themselves and create content and things.
Right.
But, you know, the real-time area is something we're still exploring and haven't really released a lot of the development technology around that. But,
uh-huh.
you know, we look at this technology around, you know, there's so many different aspects. You know, it's skin shading. It is, you know, facial capture. It's real-time puppeteering. It's
right.
sort of facial anatomy and understructures and stuff as well. So.
Right.
We're looking at all of those different areas, and obviously, as with most other groups, the wild world of machine learning has opened up many, many areas
oh,
for
yeah.
us, and we're able to leverage a lot of that technology with a lot of our data to sort of, you know, create some really amazing things.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing we discussed, actually, I want to touch on this a little bit because it's a hot subject right now, and it's. You actually used it. I didn't know the term until you told me the actual term. What do you call it? Reverse deep learning? No, not
adversarial neural networks.
Adversarial neural networks. So a neural network itself is the system that is currently being used for learning, and that's why they call it deep learning, because there's different layers of the neural network. And adversarial neural networks is one network that tries to accomplish a goal and the other one that tries to learn from it and identify it being fake or something like that?
I guess the best way I could describe it, and I may not be the best person to go into detail on this, but building one network that is really good at recognizing whether something's real or not, or accomplishing a goal or not,
mm-hmm.
and another one that's trying to accomplish the goal.
Right.
And the one that can tell whether the goal's been accomplished or not, telling the other one whether or not it's actually accomplished that goal or not. And so
right.
if you were to make one network that was built around building Obama's face.
Mm-hmm.
Another one that was really good at telling whether it was really Obama's face or not.
Right.
And then in a way you have them fighting it out, one telling the other one when it achieved its goal or not and learning
right.
from that, and the other one learning when it was correct or wrong, whether it was Obama's face, and the two of them getting better.
Right.
The one getting better at understanding whether or not it was a realistic Obama face, and the other one getting better at building an Obama face.
Mm-hmm.
And this avenue of, again, deep learning is really interesting and really helps us on the face side, sort of really taking a lot of data and realistic human data to sort of be able to create artificial human facial performances.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was fascinating and to think about that thing, because basically deep learning will sort of replace, could possibly affect creativity in a lot of ways, unless we know how to harness it in some interesting way. Because there was an article that came up with like some deep learning algorithm that was better at picking names of craft beer than other people were, because obviously craft beers got these crazy names.
Totally.
But I don't know. There's something about it that's...
It is pretty interesting. I mean, you see a lot of, you know, machine learning to sort of generate music.
Sure.
And imagery. And, you know, the more it gets trained is what is a good image or what is artistic image or what is a something that people like or not. You know,
right.
they can, those, some of the systems will become better and better producing art or better and better producing music or better and better producing humans or human motion.
Sure.
And so...
Okay. But let's use music for just one last time. Sorry, we're going to go a little long if that's cool. Something that I always thought, let's use music as the example, because I always had an apprehension towards the Pandora, Spotify automatically picking your music for you scenario, right? And one of my favorite internet radio stations is a radio station called Radio Paradise, and it's fantastic, great. It's manually handpicked music by this one guy who does the entire thing the whole time, and it's been going on for 15 years. Great stuff. And he finds all this music and all kinds of new... I'm always introduced to new music, and it's really great. Compare that to Dan Thron, who was talking about in an earlier podcast how he was on either Pandora or Spotify or whatever, started off with Black Flag, right? Pretty hardcore music. Mm-hmm. And over the course of like a 6 or 8 hours, he didn't affect it at all. Over the course of 6 or 8 hours, it slowly mellowed out to James Taylor. Like how did you go from Black Flag to, because it basically averaged itself in some way that James Taylor was the least offensive thing. Don't you think that without like there's no the creativity is going to go away in some way that's going to be like, yeah, that's fine.
I think a lot of that will, you know, if you, and this is the thing with, you know, machine learning, like as long as you can train it what to do, you've got somebody who's really good at picking out radio stations and really good at doing song progressions and creating this amazing playlist. Ultimately, enough of that information will train a system to be able to do that itself, right? And especially if that system can get feedback from how much you're liking or not liking what it's actually doing, and how much you and 10,000 other people are like or don't like what it's picking out.
Right.
It's going to get really good at picking that out. It's going to become extremely creative at picking out songs, picking out random songs, songs that you have no idea why it picked up, but just kind of work. Right. It doesn't need to know. It's never going to figure out why it worked or not. All it needs to know is that, you know, 10,000 people thought that really worked when I picked out that song at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I'm actually just now having a flashback of that exact. Do you ever, I don't know if you guys had this in South Africa, but there was a show in the United States called WKRP in Cincinnati.
Yeah, we totally had that.
You did?
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah,
absolutely. And the DJ was Venus Flytrap. Remember that was his name?
Yeah.
And he was going to work at this brand new big radio station. And it's like, it turns out that the DJ was completely run by a computer and they had a computer with a tape deck things, whatever. It's like, that's actually truly did happen. Like that really happened. So I don't know. It's just fascinating.
It was fascinating is that you actually remember that.
Yeah, I know. My brain is filled with useless information. Useless information. All right. Well, listen, Darren, this has been great. We're gonna definitely continue this conversation. I think you and I have a lot of common passions, and I think we can accomplish some great things together with Digital Human. So
that was excited. Awesome. Thank you so much. It was a huge amount of fun.
All right. Cheers. All right. Thanks, man.